Call the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Quorum might again be present. I'll have to ask members and members of the audience to forgive me today. I seem to have captured the institutional cold and seem to be given to uncontrollable fits of coughing. I'll try to suppress that as much as possible. First order of business is the approval of the minutes from February 25th. Representative Kalin, would you be so kind as to make that motion?
See me moving right now. Okay, I'm making that motion. To approve the minutes of February 25th, 2008.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Representative Junkie, House File 3343.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you or someone want to move the bill, and then I have a DE amendment that'll get it in the shape I'd like it.
I would be happy to do that. As the second author on the bill, Representative Junkie, I will move House File 3343 to be before us for consideration. And
yep.
I will then move the DE1 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adopting the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and be as brief as possible. I'm joined at the table by our good friend, who you all know, Mr. Mike Bowl from the Department of Commerce, who is intimately involved with this, too, and can offer any explanation that may be needed beyond my scope of understanding. How about that? All right. Members, what this is, the DE amendment you're working on, this is a wind aggregation bill. And where this came about was about a year ago, I believe, or so. We were out at the University of Minnesota Morris for a meeting, Mr. Bull and I and a number of other people. And at the time, Morris was talking about installing a second wind generator, a windmill out there on the campus. As you know, if you've been out there, they have one. They're doing research now for wind anhydrous project, which is well on its way. And they were ready to add a second unit, so they put out an RFP, and I think five or six people picked up the RFP packets and were considering the bid. Well, when the RFP deadline came and handed it in, they didn't receive one bid. And so they called two or three of those folks that they knew, who they had worked with in the past, and said, "What's up? Why did you not bid on this project?" And frankly, the answer they got was, with the popularity of these units now and with the establishment of a lot of our renewable energy goals, obviously, they said, we're really not accepting orders of less than 10 units from anyone. And so the U of M quickly decided they had some problems getting an order for a single windmill. So, and we suspect and know that's going to be the case if that trend continues. So what this bill simply allows is for the Department of Commerce to become an aggregator. Wilmer New Mississippi Utilities or Candy Light Co-op Electric or our school districts or U of M Morris or other entities in the state, and you see a number of those listed in the first paragraph, can contact the Department of Commerce and tell them we want one or two windmills, and they will aggregate that order then with the group of people and be able to place a larger order with the manufacturers. Again, really cost, we're not paying for them, but we are certifying that they're ready to go and have the funds available. We'll put them on the list and place the full order. I just draw your attention on the first paragraph. lines 1-5 talk about development assistance laws, Goal 7, Chapter 55, Article 2. That was a Kate Knuth initiative last session, so we're just adding on to what she did in there. Give her credit for that. Also added language on the back was requested by one of your committee members, which we think is a good idea, too. There's a report required back, so if they start doing this and gathering names, and we know you'll be curious and you've indicated an interest in to know how this is going and is it working and how many people are joining in to aggregate and put in orders on windmills. So that's the bill in a nutshell. Again, I have Mr. Bull here to help answer any questions you may have. It's fairly simple. It's just, again, allowing the department to develop this program and utilize a purchasing aggregation program for wind turbines. That's the bill.
Representative Junkie or Mr. Bull, could you explain to us what the statutory citation in Subdivision 4 is regarding assessment?
Chair, I'm Mike Bull, the Deputy Director of the Office of Energy Security at the Minnesota Department of Commerce, if I will. The this is an existing assessment authority for the Reliability Administrator. So it's a carve-out under that existing assessment as opposed to additional, a new assessment authority. And one of the, I think to build on what Representative Junkie mentioned was that we're going to integrate this program into the Rural Wind Development Assistance Program that was an initiative for Representative Knuth that was passed last session. The Southwest Initiative Foundation will be providing a statewide rural wind technical assistance program, partnering along with the nonprofit CBET, the CBET initiative. And one of their charges from last session was to provide turbine purchasing assistance. So this is entirely consistent with their the responsibilities that you laid with them last session, and we'll work that in with that in that program.
Questions to the bill, Representative Taylor.
I think I'll pass.
Mr. Chairman?
No. Representative Hackworth.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ball or Representative Junkie, are we going to put an amount in there in that line 2.6?
Mr. Chair, we're nailing down what the Southwest Initiative Foundation thinks they'll need. We're on the order of 100,000. Out of that million, so that if that's if the committee would like to put a number in today, that would be the sort of the order that a magnitude that we'd be thinking about.
Representative Hackworth,
well, I think we have to fill in the blank, Mr. Chairman. What do you think?
Well, certainly that has to occur at some point, Representative Hackworth, and if you would like to make a motion to do that, I think it would be in order.
Amendment, Mr. Chairman.
For 100,000?
Yep.
Mr. Bull, Representative Junkie, you wish to comment on that?
And Mr. Chair, certainly if that's what they think they need, and again, this is out of existing funds, so it's not new money, it's existing money. That'd be fine, and I'm sure the Finance Committee will want to see it through there, too, then.
Yes, it does have to stop in the Finance Committee, Representative Hackworth.
So. I'm on that, too.
So we'll see this again.
So I move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Very well. Mr. Eloff, you...
I've got it.
Can you just read for the record what that would be, Mr. Eloff?
On page 2, line 6, after the dollar sign, insert 100,000.
Very good. That is the amendment. All those in favor of the Hackworth amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, I will move that House File 3343 as amended be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Appreciate it.
Representative Slope. Representative Slocum, House File
3368. There are two amendments that I'd like to deal with first.
First, you need to move your bill, Representative Slocum.
I move my bill.
Chairman?
Representative Hackworth.
What is the proper motion then to bring the bill before the committee? Is it going to, where are we going to send it after this?
Representative Hackworth, I believe the bill can be sent to the general register should it pass out of this committee.
Okay.
Very well. Representative Slocum, we have your bill before us. Did you want to take up the amendments first?
Mm-hmm, I take it. There is an A1 amendment that I believe you have.
The representative Slocum moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment?
I would like to add one small oral amendment to the amendment. On line 1.3, page 3, line 4, 1.3, where it says, in construction-related activities, I'd like to delete construction-related activities and insert construction and related activity required for reconnection service. Reconnection of service.
Mr. Lewis, do you have that?
Yes, on the page 3368A1 amendment, line 1.3, delete the hyphen between construction and related and insert the word and. After activities, insert required for reconnection of service.
That's correct.
Any discussion to the amendment? As amended. Seeing not all those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Slocum, you want to go to A2?
Mr. Chair, A2 amends on page 3, delete section 5, and on page 4, delete section 6, and renumber the sections and sequence and correct the internal references.
Representative Slocum, would you like to move adoption of the A2 amendment?
I would.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? That amendment is adopted. So, Representative Slocum, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill adds to some of the consumer protection legislation that was passed last session. It provides a couple of additional provisions related to payment arrangements, cold weather rules protection, service deposits, and utility service restoration. As far as I'm aware, there's no opposition to this bill. It's the product of consensus among advocates and utility representatives. Ms. Marshall, who's the Executive Director for Energy Sense Coalition, will briefly walk through the specifics.
Ms. Marshall, welcome to this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Pam Marshall. I'm Director of the Energy Sense Coalition, and our organization promotes more affordable energy service through legislative and regulatory advocacy and also through direct bill payment and conservation assistance programs. In the first section of the bill, a deadline is added to the reporting requirements that were enacted last session. The data in those reports is informative and instructive, and we feel it's necessary to ensure that it's also timely to be as useful as possible. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill include two modifications to the current cold weather rule statute. That statute protects consumers against heating service disconnections during the winter months. In the event that a winter service reconnection is necessary, the bill requires utilities to use reasonable efforts to restore service within 24 hours. The second provision under the cold weather rule provision in the bill adds a requirement that utilities consider the financial circumstances of their non-low-income customers, those above 50% of the state median income, when negotiating payment arrangements during the winter months. More customers are struggling to pay high utility bills now than it's been true, I think, ever, at least in my experience, and especially those just over the income guidelines for the cold weather rule. Now, under this bill, their economic, financial, and extenuating circumstances would be considered. In Section 4, that section also requires the utilities to consider a customer's financial circumstances when negotiating past due bill payment arrangements for the remainder of the year. So it extends what we just did above in the cold weather rule section. It also prohibits utilities from charging an additional service deposit to a customer who's past due but is current on a payment arrangement. And Mr. Chair and members, we think these are incremental, important steps, and we urge your support of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Members, any questions for Ms. Marshall or questions to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Slocum would renew her motion that House Bill 3368, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hackbar.
I'm sorry, I just happened to be reading this this one sentence here in Section 4. Maybe we could have defined what customer who has entered and is reasonably on time under an anticipated payment agreement. What does that mean? What does reasonably on time mean?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that language is the same language that's actually included in the cold weather rule statute that governs the rural electric co-ops and municipal utilities. And while it seems to work, while seemingly vague, the problem we get into if we try to define reasonable, we're left with being too prescriptive. And so the agreements that we've come to in the past include that language and typically mean within 1 or 2 months. That's how people interpret reasonably on time.
Representative Hackbarth, I think Mr. Eloff has an additional observation about that.
Okay.
Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that under Subdivision 1 of the Cold Weather Rule, there's a definition of reasonably timely payment. And it says reasonably timely payment means payment within 5 working days of agreed upon due date. If members are comfortable with using that definition, I would suggest amending line 3.23 by inserting after the word is making and after reasonably timely payment, so we have the exact same definition or exact same term that has the definition that's already in the statute.
Representative Slocum or Ms. Marshall? Yes.
Mr. Chair, can you tell me again where the 5 working days is included?
Right, I'm looking at 216B.096 of the Cold Weather Rule, Subdivision 1. There's a number of definitions there, and the definition of reasonably timely payment means payment within 5 working days of agreed-upon due date.
Well, Mr. Chair, that cold weather, that subdivision that you cited is the one that governs the IOUs or the co-ops and the
Public utility.
Okay. I'm not aware if that definition is included in the cooperative and municipal cold weather rule, but the provision before you in Section 4 of the bill actually includes rural electorates, municipals, and public utilities. And I guess my preference would be to stay away from stringent deadlines when we're dealing with pretty significant dollar amounts and let the utility and the customers work it out.
Representative Hackbar, do you want to pursue this further?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Justifier said in her testimony that reasonably was explained in other areas of the statute, and I think Mr. Eloff explained where that was. I think I would have to go along with Mr. Eloff and agree that we should probably include that in Section 4. That would be my motion, Mr. Chairman, to do that. Include that as an amendment.
Mr. Eloff, could you tell us what that amendment would be?
Page 3, line 23, after is, insert, making. Also on page 3, line 23, after the word reasonably, insert, timely payment. But actually, Ms. Marshall is correct that the definition applies only to public utilities, and since these provisions are applying to other utilities, even putting them in there won't apply to these utilities unless we also include the definition in that other section.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Representative Hackbarth withdraws his amendment. Thank you, sir. For further discussion to the bill. Seeing none, Representative Slocum renews her motion that House File 3368, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Slocum.
Representative Kelsey, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 3401 be before us for consideration.
Okay, Representative.
And Madam Chair, I would also move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Kelsey moves House File number 3401 and his DE2 amendment. Does everybody have that amendment?
I think it's just being distributed now, Madam Chair. Since we lead all amendments, obviously that just puts the bill in the order in which we'd like to have it considered.
Okay, any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, those in favor of that motion, signify.
Okay.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I believe that there was just in the policy language that we adopted in Representative Knuth's green bond bill, there was just one little technical error on line 1.18. I think we want to get rid of the word complete to describe replacement of mechanical ventilation or cooling system to define major renovation. The spirit of the bill, or the spirit of the amendment that I worked out with Representative Gunther, and appreciate Representative Hackworth's agreement as well to agree with the general floor, just to describe why we may actually be required. It may limit to the point where if you're not replacing a fan, but you're replacing every other part of the ventilation system, it'll just give a tiny little bit more leeway to adopt the most technically accurate definition and not tie their hands too much. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hilty, do you want to speak?
Madam Chair, I think we have two possibilities here. It is simply we can adopt the amendment and then amend the bill, or I can simply incorporate the change into the amendment. Since we haven't acted on that, it would be agreeable to do that.
So, Mr. Elas, do you need to read the correction for the amendment?
Senator Kalin, we're saying to just delete the word complete on line 118.
That is correct, Mr. Elas.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I will incorporate that, and then I would move adoption of the DE2 amendment.
Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Hilty, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have had to, under the current circumstances of my state of health, I've had to impose on Mr. Strom, who's with me at the table, to pick up the duty of introducing the bill, and since he's much more qualified to do that than I. Anyway, I would just like to have Mr. Strom walk us through the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Strom. Please identify yourself for the case.
Thanks very much, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Strom. I run an organization called the Center for Energy and Environment. We're a nonprofit organization that's been doing work on energy efficiency and renewable energy and energy policy for over 25 years. Been doing a lot of work in Minnesota mostly, but in other states as well. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about this bill. I think it's a great bill. And let me just start with basically explaining the concept a little bit. The concept we are calling Sustainable Building 2030, and this is based upon a national initiative called the Architecture 2030 Challenge. This is a concept originated by an architect named Ed Masria, who's done extensive work on energy for probably about 30 years. This concept has wide support from architects throughout the country. All sorts of professional organizations in other states are moving towards supporting this concept. And basically the way it works is by accepting this Architecture 2030 Challenge, new buildings and buildings that are substantially remodeled meet ever-increasing energy efficiency standards. The basic idea is that you start with the average building in 2003, not a new building, not an old building, the average building in 2003, and you would try to immediately design new buildings to be 50% better than that building in terms of their carbon-based energy. And these standards increase then each year. In 2010, they'd be 60% better than that 2003 building. 70% would be 2015, it would be 70%. 2020 would be 80%. In 2025, it would be 90%. Now, this isn't done only with energy efficiency. It's done with energy efficiency and a combination of renewable energies that are renewable energies that's being added to the system. So as the renewable energy standards increase, we would start to credit that in meeting these building guidelines. And I know this seems a little complicated, and that's one of the purposes of doing this legislation the way it is to have a bunch of experts figure out exactly what this means for each building type in Minnesota. So as people try to meet these guidelines, they can have unambiguous benchmarks of what they need to do. So these standards are increasing, as I've mentioned, every 5 years, or perhaps more frequently if Minnesota decides to do that. The idea is that by 2030, we try and minimize carbon emissions from buildings. The genesis of this idea for Minnesota came from the governor's climate change task force and a technical committee called the Residential Commercial Industrial Technical Work Group. That committee loved this idea, supported it, probably it was their favorite recommendation. And their only condition on that was they wanted to make sure that as we move forward with these ever-increasing standards, that they be cost-effective in Minnesota buildings. So that's one of the things that the bill that's before you requires. The other condition they had was they didn't want to have unfunded mandates for local government buildings, and the bill as written really doesn't have any mandates for local government buildings. I want to emphasize these standards, once they're completely developed, would be incorporated into the state's sustainable building guidelines. They'd be the energy portion of the sustainable building guidelines. So in that sense, they would become mandatory for state-bonded buildings. For any other buildings, they would simply be voluntary guidelines. And the idea is that utility programs would be designed to help encourage people to meet these voluntary guidelines, but they'd simply be voluntary guidelines. So looking at the Delete Everything Amendment, just very quickly, as Representative Kalin mentioned, the first part of this includes some modifications to the sustainable building guidelines that account for major remodeling. In the past, those that were only new buildings, and now your committee has previously approved this for major remodeling of buildings. And it also states that as these architectures or Minnesota 2030 guidelines are developed, they will be incorporated into the sustainable building guidelines. Section 2 of the bill starts with using some of the existing utility money that was approved last year for utility research, and it allocates up to $500,000 of that money to the Department of Commerce and then to the Center for Sustainable Design Research at the University of Minnesota. And it's an up to amount. It doesn't have to be that much, but that's the amount that can be spent on this purpose. Most of that research money is being spent in existing buildings because that's where most of the energy use is. But this would target some of that money to new buildings and buildings that are substantially remodeling and try to encourage that we meet the highest possible standards for making those buildings more efficient. And the purpose, as explained in the bill, is very simple. We're trying to make the best buildings we can as long as they're cost effective. In subdivision 9B, it specifically directs the commissioner of the Department of Commerce, which is now called the Office of Energy Security, to contract with the Center for Sustainable Design Research at the university. This is a process that was used in developing the original sustainability guidelines for the state. And as I understand it, it was a process that involved a lot of stakeholders. And it worked, as you'll hear later, those sustainability guidelines have worked very, very effectively. So it's a process that people are familiar with, comfortable with, and it gives everyone a chance to participate, including utilities, because utilities are a key player in developing these guidelines and implementing this program. The bill further states that the guidelines are to be based upon energy use and carbon emissions per square foot. And this can get a little complicated, and that's why the charges to this this group of people working with the Center for Sustainable Building Design to figure out exactly how to do that can be a little complicated, because if you just save energy, some energies are more carbon intensive than others. So if you save electricity, you'll end up saving more carbon than if you just save natural gas. The goal of this is to try and save energy and at the same time maximize carbon reduction. So hopefully out of this process will come a simple way of explaining what those guidelines are so that as people develop these new buildings, they can go for those benchmarks and be assured that we're maximizing the reductions in carbon emissions. This $500,000 that is allocated has a limit. Only $150,000 of it can be spent directly on administrative activities and coordination activities. The rest of it has to be contracted out with the oversight of the Department of Commerce for specific tasks, for example, researching exactly what is the baseline for schools and hospitals in Minnesota. Right now, the baseline data is fairly skimpy, especially for some building types. So there's a lot of nuts and bolts work that needs to be done to operationalize these guidelines. Also, once they're operationalized, the idea is that we would educate architects and engineers and others exactly how they work and what their benefits are. Another thing that's likely to happen is that they would develop a labeling system for buildings so that if somebody built a building to this standard, they could then get a label that showed that what a high-performing building it was relative to other buildings. A number of European countries are using this approach. And then the bill also requires that the Department of Commerce direct utilities to modify their conservation improvement programs for new buildings and substantially remodeled buildings to try and achieve these guidelines. Now, most utilities already offer programs for new buildings. What we're doing here is directing that they try and improve those programs and try and meet these more aggressive energy saving standards if that's cost effective. And realize implicit in all of this is this question of cost effectiveness. And the bill states that cost effectiveness will be determined in the same manner that cost effectiveness is determined for the existing utility SIP program. And that's something that the state has probably a couple decades worth of experience with. Utilities are very familiar with it. And it's a very rigorous way of looking at cost effectiveness from a wide variety of standpoints, society as a whole, the utility, individual participants, and so on. So that will be guiding the whole program. But as you'll hear from other presenters, there is a lot of potential to do a really great job and build much better buildings cost effectively. And this approach would capture that. The last thing the bill does is it requires that the Department of Commerce report back to the legislature every 3 years on how are we doing on these cost effectiveness indicators, how effective is this program, are we saving a lot of energy, is there a lot more potential to do this, and also the bill directs the commissioner to recommend whether or not this process should be continued. So that's a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Brown.
Questions? Representative
Hope,
did you have other
questions? Madam Chair, we do. I think next on the list we have John Carmody from the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carmody. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you. Let me, if you don't mind, put my slides up here while we're getting ready. Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm John Carmody. I'm the Director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research. Okay. Great. Thank you. As I said, I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. We are the group that led the team that put together the current Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines, which are required on all state buildings or state-bonded buildings. That went into effect in 2004. We also do a variety of activities for state and local government agencies, either assisting them in writing guidelines and standards or assisting them with particular projects that they want to make sustainable. I was also a member of one of the working groups, the RCI Technical Working Group, in the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, where this idea was generated. And finally, we do a lot of building evaluation for various state and local government agencies as well to determine how the buildings work after they're designed and in operation. I'd like to note, before I start with some slides, the success of the Minnesota Sustainable Guidelines Project so far. Since 2004, there have been 50 projects that those guidelines have been applied to. That's 3.7 million square feet of space that's been built, and an estimated $1,670,000 per year in energy cost savings due to the application of the guidelines. That translates into 47,000 tons of CO2 savings every year. This first slide, I think many of you must know, buildings have a big impact on energy and carbon emissions. 65% of total electricity use is associated with buildings. 36% of, or about a third of, the primary energy use in the country is associated with buildings. If, though, you add in building materials and building construction processes and those embodied effects, it can be as high as 48%. Nearly half of all energy use in the country is associated with buildings. And, of course, buildings also have big impacts on other resource issues such as water, waste, raw materials, and the health of the occupants. I'm going to just show a couple of slides here to give you a little bit of background on the state of the green building, sustainable building movement, which has been evolving rapidly in the last few years. Many people may have heard of the LEED rating system. It's widely used. It's a checklist where you get points for doing good things in terms of energy, water, materials, and so forth. And you, depending on how many points you get a silver, a gold, or a platinum rating for your building. It's had a big impact in the marketplace. It's had a big impact in educating clients and architects and so forth. But there are other competing rating systems, both nationally and regionally, and they all arise for different reasons. They're better suited to a particular project type, or in the case of the regional ones, they're better suited to meet the goals of a particular region or the climate conditions and so forth. The bottom one on this slide is the logo for our Minnesota guidelines, which don't use a point-based system, but instead prescribe things like 30% energy improvement over Minnesota code, which is more of a hard performance requirement as opposed to you must get a certain number of points, where the points don't necessarily translate into a particular level of energy savings. That's a weakness of that type of system. So all of these are at play in Minnesota at any one time. And then if you look on the residential side of the world, that was commercial buildings, there's also a LEED system for that, but that's not dominant in the marketplace. In fact, in Minnesota, there's two things that are emerging. One is the Green Communities Program, which is applied to all of the MHFA multifamily housing projects, for the affordable housing projects, as a requirement, which is a great leap forward that Minnesota Housing has done that. And then in the private sector, you have Minnesota Green Star, which the Twin Cities Builders Association has adopted as their program. So you can see there's a great deal of activity. Many of these things have emerged just in the last 2 or 3 years. Everyone wants to do the right thing. The downside of it is that there's a certain amount of confusion when you have all these competing rating systems and guidelines and so forth. And I think what we're trying to get at in this bill is to make sure we focus on the bottom line, that regardless of what approach you take or what rating system you take, you want to achieve a certain level of carbon emissions and energy use to improve that over time. This slide just happens to show that there's also guidelines emerging for development or neighborhood scale projects. And when you get into a neighborhood scale, you can do some things you can't do on an individual building. You can look at district energy systems. You can look at, water treatment systems that are shared. You can look at the infrastructure that goes into something. So you can actually make even bigger impacts because you're looking at land use and infrastructure patterns. This Architecture 2030 that Sheldon mentioned is a national movement, essentially, in which people are saying, let's focus on the bottom line of carbon and let's go in logical steps. Let's start with a baseline. Let's be 50% better than that baseline today, 60% by 2010, 70% by 2015, and so forth, till we get to a carbon neutral building by 2030. If you look at the graph here, the red line that keeps going up is business as usual. If we essentially just stick with our current energy codes and levels and keep building, we're not going to solve the turn around the carbon emissions problem. If we meet these 2030 standards, the lower line shows that we can actually decrease over this period of 20 years and really address this problem in a serious way. This bill actually gives Minnesota an opportunity to be somewhat of a leader in terms of taking the Architecture 2030 idea, which everyone buys into, and refining it and making sure that it works effectively in a particular state or region. So to summarize, there's a few trends in this world of green building guidelines and standards. There's a diverse set of guidelines and systems that are continually evolving. They're now being adopted in various ways by states and cities, and they're becoming code as opposed to just being voluntary guidelines where you do it to get the points or get the recognition. There's also, in my opinion, a move away from these kind of simple point-based systems into really focusing on the carbon and energy bottom line that we're trying to achieve. And then finally, there's also introduction of better tools and information that lets us understand, like, life cycle assessment, the embodied effects of the materials we use, the construction processes, and so forth. So this is a area of great research activity and a lot of evolving information. And then finally, there's a new focus on not just meeting some standards and getting the building built and walking away from it, but looking at how it performs in reality. And we all know that you can have a good design but have it not necessarily perform well in reality. We want to track that and make the improvements and the corrections as needed to ensure that performance. I'm going to, as a part of my presentation here, I'm going to show you a couple of case studies from LHC Architects. Rick Carter, the leader of the architecture group there, sometimes joins in this presentation and talks about his own projects. He couldn't be with us today. But I think these examples are really powerful. They show that this is very achievable today, and buildings we're doing right now are doing this. This isn't pie-in-the-sky work. The first slide here just talks about how we measure performance, and that EUI means energy use intensity, and what it's really talking about, how much energy are we using per square foot in a building per year. So the typical units we would use would be kBTU per square foot per year. And this format that is used here has these four orange bars. And so for a typical building, the first tallest bar is our baseline. That's the, let's say we're talking about schools, that's the average energy use for schools in Minnesota. The second bar is showing our 2030 goal, and it shows what we're trying to reach at this point in time, not the one we're trying to reach in 2030, but if we're scaling up, what do we have to reach in 2008? The third line is an actual LHC project in which we're saying, here's the calculated performance when they do the design, and then here's the actual performance when we build the building. So if I apply that to one of their projects. You can see this is the Quality Bicycle product building out in Bloomington, which is a relatively new project. And you can see from the, I'm going to turn this a little so I can read the slides while I'm talking about them. You can see that it uses 42 kBTUs per year actual. And so it's actually exceeding these 2030 standards. And you can see that they spent $750,000 additionally on the project. They're getting back $75,000 a year, so that's a 10-year payback. Now, this is a longer payback than most projects to achieve this performance because the owners wanted to put in a big solar electric system. It has a 40-kilowatt solar PV system on the roof of the project, which those things typically have longer paybacks than a lot of the energy conservation strategies. So this is on the high side, but it's still quite reasonable. The second example here is a high school in Two Harbors, Minnesota. This uses more energy conservation, nothing exotic like solar collectors, but you can see from those bars down in the corner, the 2030 goal would be 56 kBTUs per square foot per year, and they modeled it to meet that goal, and then they the actual performance is even a little bit better than that. So here again, we have a less than five-year payback. They spent $240,000, they're saving $50,000 a year on this school. Less than five-year payback, which is a 20% return on investment. So that's a very doable, reasonable project to meet the goal. And then the third one, the last one, is the Alvo Veterans and Community Studio Apartments, an affordable housing project done up in St. Cloud. And this particular project, again, exceeds the 2030 goal, and the indication is that there's $400,000 of additional costs. All of that went into a geothermal heating and cooling system, and that saves $50,000 a year. So again, it's an eight-year payback. You can also geothermal is one of the more expensive capital items. It happened to work out that the costs for the construction were good here and they were able to make that additional investment. Sometimes that isn't possible. But I think these in total show that this is very achievable. People are doing it today on public projects, and there will be a presentation by another architect a little bit later showing some real buildings as well.
Mr. Conti, are there any questions?
Thank you, Chair and Mr. Carmody. So if the University of Minnesota at this current point proposes to construct a building and get money out of the bonding bill, mm-hmm. is it correct to say that the building that would get built would comply with the sustainable guidelines you developed?
The current sustainable building design guidelines, yes that are in force now.
Yes, okay. Just for the record, then, I learned that there's an example of one of these buildings that wants to be built in the University of Minnesota's bonding request at the University of Minnesota at Morris. I wouldn't care if it's on the top of the IDS tower or wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I understand $500,000, of course, you know, it's a good deal, support it, you know, move ahead in 2030. But there's an example right now of a building we can build that meets these standards at a University of Minnesota campus. And the only reason I bring it up is because the Senate, in its infinite wisdom, did not include this in their bonding bill. So if you know any senators on the bonding committee, go talk to them about it. They should fund the University of Minnesota's request because it's exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just more of a comment than it is anything about your bill.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, Mr. Carmody, are there projects that you know of that the university is embarking on that can not only meet the, obviously they have to meet the sustainable design guidelines if they're receiving state bonding, but could meet any of the out years targets, maybe the 70% or 80% reductions of 15 and 2020 reductions today, or even go down to zero carbon and be our leader?
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, the buildings that are being built today are not going to be at that 80 to 90% better level, but we expect in 15 years the technology as well as the energy price structure and so forth will make it quite achievable to do that. There's some excellent buildings, though, being done at the university, very cutting edge. And the next two speakers will show one or more of those, if I remember their case studies correctly. So we're not at the point where on a public building we're going to some zero carbon emissions. The payback just wouldn't be there today. But they should be as time unfolds.
Representative Salen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quick follow-up. Is my memory correct that, that the Center for Sustainable Building Research is working on a TCA grant to develop a design protocol to go towards zero energy?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Salen. Yes, we're doing a small grant for PCA. It's really to develop a methodology to calculate carbon in all building projects in Minnesota, so there's a consistent methodology.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carnotti, is it? A moment ago you mentioned that one of the ways that we would achieve these deep reductions, meet these ambitious goals, is, among other things, if the price of energy is such that it helps get there. Could you explain what that means? Because I'm hearing something that you may not be intending for me to hear. What does that mean?
Mr. Carmody.
Madam Chair, Representative, we expect that building let me just take a step back from that. We expect that building technology, right today, we can meet these goals. As the goals get more aggressive, as we go through time, we expect that new building technologies will come to the marketplace, as well as the cost of certain things like solar collectors and so forth in mass production are likely to come down. So on that side of it, we expect it will be more financially feasible to do the higher performance building. The energy prices in the future, we don't actually know what those are. Mm-hmm. I'm saying there's a certain amount of assumption that either energy prices or the fact that people will build the cost of carbon through cap and trade or some other carbon tax mechanism will embed that in energy. So as energy prices go up, it becomes easier to reach this cost effectiveness standard that we'll be setting. That's what I meant by that.
Representative Beard, can you follow up?
Well, I got to ponder that statement for a little while and just think about what that means. So what it sounds like is that we need energy prices to continue to ratchet higher to make this scheme work. And I want to be clear that that's not the case. But perhaps it is. Maybe that's the assumptions that are built in and that's what we need to have happen. Then I guess we're on guard for not driving up the cost of energy just so we make these programs work. So I'm trying to get my mental arms around how a reduction in energy use isn't just dependent on technology and building style and not necessarily on energy costs. Do you follow me? Follow where my question could go?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think this concept is, the main purpose of this is to reduce energy and to reduce carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the energy price comments that I made are not really critical to the success, to this idea or the success or failure of this idea. I mean, I think we don't really understand where energy prices are going to be. I was just saying that it was likely that some things that don't seem cost-effective today will probably seem cost-effective in
okay.
the future for a variety of reasons, one of which might be energy price increases.
That makes sense. Thank you. Thank you.
Not for sorry.
Further questions? Oh, I'm sorry.
No. Just a quick one. When you've been making some of the calculations on payback, number of years and so forth involved,
yep.
I remember my when I replaced my furnace, I had a choice between the high-tech and the not-quite-as-high-tech. And the installer said, you'd be better off with the not-quite-so-high-tech because the high-tech is going to cost you more when it comes to maintenance. When you have a failure, it's going to be significant as far as cost goes. So when you're talking about these paybacks, that's assuming that nothing breaks or fails during that 10 or however, whatever years you're calculating. I mean, we're assuming that all this equipment, all the high-tech, operates flawlessly with no failures.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Carmody.
Representative. Well, I think you're raising a really important issue. I think when I present this information about simple paybacks, it's not including the life cycle maintenance costs and so forth. But I think the intent is that as we bring forward newer and better technologies, that they will be proven technologies. They won't be things that are going to, you know, not be durable and cost more in the long run. But it is true when you have constantly emerging new technologies, you have to be really careful about that. And I think we have to be kind of prudent and guide the public about what makes sense now and what is still kind of an emerging technology that I wouldn't necessarily invest in now, till we have it.
Mr. Tugg, I think we'll bring out the next testifier, Mr. John White from the White Group.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carmody.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Will you please state your name for the record?
Thank you. My name is John White. I'm founder of a Minnesota company called the White Group. Madam Chair, members, I'm going to try to be real brief. My role here today is to talk to you a little bit about our observations in terms of the feasibility and practicality of something like this Architecture 2030 Challenge. I'm going to just say a couple things about our company. I founded the company 31 years ago to do energy and environmental consulting in buildings, and that has been a singular purpose during that entire time. And we've seen quite a few ups and downs, and whether energy was a problem or energy wasn't a problem, is the environment really being harmed? Isn't the environment being harmed? Anyway, we have consistently just worked on trying to make better buildings. We've got 583 completed projects throughout the United States, representing over 120 million square feet of building construction. We've also are in the process now of helping the state of Minnesota benchmark better than 5,000 of their public buildings. The work that we've done has represented 604 kilotons a year of air pollution reduction and over $58 million in energy savings annually to our customers and clients. Is the possibility of 2030, what is its possible effectiveness? What we've learned in working with architects, engineers, building owners, and contractors, especially since we've been able to work with the Excel Energy Design Assistance Program and some other programs from other utilities in the Midwest, we have seen them very effectively lower energy demand from buildings. That's what we're really talking about here, trying to make buildings demand less and less energy from the grid and from the pipeline until they become carbon neutral by 2030. We collected some data from 441 projects we've worked on since 2000. That represents about 59 million square feet of buildings. The energy savings range in those buildings were kind of wide, 2% to 78%. Once upon a time, when I was working on this 30 years ago, a fellow called that the average curve of jerks and winners. The average is 33%, and the average has been 33% for a number of years. To reach 2030, we need to do better than that. On the other hand, we've seen $26 million in energy cost savings just in this package of buildings, and the average payback on these buildings is 2.5 years, and that is a simple average payback. What's the added cost divided by what's the annual energy savings? The Sustainable Building 2030 program does pose a significant challenge. In the last 30 years, energy use in buildings has declined rather modestly, as you can see from this graph. But Sustainable Buildings 2030 accelerates that reduction in buildings' demand for energy very rapidly. On the other side, we know that energy conservation is a proven strategy. We emphasize that energy conservation must be achieved by practical means. There's a lot of impractical ways to save energy. We concentrate on the practical stuff. We worship at the meter, as we say. In the end, we believe that the goals are challengeable but achievable, and let me show you some numbers we were able to come up with. Out of that package of buildings that we took a look at, those 400 and some odd buildings, we found that 25 buildings meet or exceed the 2020 targets as of today. There's about 1.5 million square feet of them. They're saving about $1.2 million annually, and the return on investment of that package of buildings is about 18%. In other words, a little longer than a 5-year simple payback. Now, I kind of red dotted a few of these buildings. What I want to point out, though, is that even today, a few of these buildings have come close to meeting the 2030 goal, even though it's 2008. One of them has far exceeded the goal. But in every case, these are buildings designed by Midwest architects and engineers, commissioned by Midwest clients. These folks were not forced into doing any of these things. These were all this is a voluntary energy design assistance program participation. And all in every case, the client chose to save significantly more energy than the average so that he could reap some benefits in the future. And I'm going to point out three buildings that we were intimately involved in this process. The first building I worked on personally very closely with the architect and the owner in 1978 was the Security State Bank building in Wells, Minnesota. The president of that building, Pat Hart, he chose to build a building that used one-third the energy of its contemporaries. I went back and looked at that building in 2000, and it's still operating that way. The energy use has gone up a little bit because the building is quite popular, and so it's used in the evenings when the lights have to be on a little bit more, and so the air conditioning and the heat might be on a little bit longer. But the building is still running very well. It just sits there and works, which is what we look for. Second building, in 2000, the Iowa Association of Municipal Utilities chose to build a building that would lead its folks by example. That building cost 2% more to build. It paid off with a 28% return. We monitored the energy use on that building every month. Its monitored energy use is 32% that of its contemporary. And last but not least, in 2002, the Minnesota Science Museum chose to build the first building of its kind, one that would consume no net energy. That, in fact, does have a zero carbon footprint. The building has actually been a net producer of energy, returning 36 more energy to the grid than it consumes. Now, these savings come from four, as I say, fairly practical, straightforward methodologies that we've consistently applied for dozens of years. First of all, you design the building to minimize its demand for energy, to minimize its load. Secondly, what load you have to deliver, whether for lights or heating or cooling or ventilation, you use the most efficient systems that you can. And then when you have to turn to energy, use renewable energy sources whenever possible. And last but not least, operate the building properly. Poor operation is catastrophic. Proper operation is critical. That's the extent of my comments. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions, members? Representative Weston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify your statement, like on the Science Museum, did you say 36% return?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it returned 36% more energy to the grid than it consumes. So it actually is a little power plant.
Okay. And
question?
One of your points is you use renewable energy as one of the four tenets of designing the building. When you say return, I mean, you're still saying you're still factoring in a cost for that renewable energy, but there's benefits from that energy. You're not counting that as a zero cost energy.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm probably confusing things. That normally, when I was speaking of return, I was speaking of financial return, like average simple payback. In this particular case, I'm saying that this particular building is fitted with a photovoltaic system. And the photovoltaic system not only supplies all of the energy needs of the building on an annual basis, but it actually runs the meter backwards, so it returns electrical energy into the power grid. But this is not a financial return or financial payback. I don't even have the numbers on the building. It is, since it's 100% photovoltaic, though, it would be quite a bit more expensive to build than your average commercial building today.
What is the cost of that building compared to others?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going to have to hedge a little bit. The building was expensive to build. I don't honestly have the exact numbers. I know there was a problem with building it where it was. It had to be put on a significant pilot. But I can get that information for you, and I'd be glad to send it to your office, to the chair, or Representative Hilty, whoever would like to have.
Yeah, if you could send it to the committee and back to us. I mean, I'm just curious how, if it's returning 36% more than it uses, does it get paid for some of that? And if that's the case, at some point, doesn't that pay off, or is it still not a payoff, a winning proposition?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're exactly right. It not only turns kilowatts to the utility, but running the meter backwards does mean that they get a negative utility bill from time to time. Over the course of years, however, I don't know how long it would take for that to pay off this fairly expensive photovoltaic system. So that information, I'm afraid, I don't have. I'm sorry.
All right.
Thank you. Further questions, members? Thank you, Mr. White, for your testimony. And we have one more testifier, Mr. Doug Pierce. And members, I believe we were set to adjourn at 3:45, but we started a little late, so we are going to be running 50 minutes late.
Madam Chair.
Representative Weston.
What's the disposition of this bill? Is it moving out of here today?
It's going to be laid over as amended for possible inclusion of the omnibus.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Representatives, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Douglas Pierce. I'm a practicing architect with the firm of Perkins & Will in Minneapolis. I'm here today representing the 2,000 members of the American Institute of Architects, Minnesota. We're a chapter of AIA National, which has 78,000 members across the U.S. I'm also here on behalf of my firm, Perkins & Will. We're the second largest design firm in the U.S., and in May of 2006, we became the first international firm to adopt the 2030 goals for building energy use. As architects, we believe global warming is a threat to our country's vitality and prosperity. We also know there are economically beneficial ways to slow it, and improving building energy use can have a large impact, and it is economically effective. As you heard before, buildings, both commercial and residential, are responsible for approximately 48% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. 39% of that comes from their day-to-day operations. The remainder comes from manufacturing and construction activities. In 2004, AIA Minnesota was the first AIA chapter in the country to draft and adopt a position on climate change, and along with calling for energy-efficient buildings, the position endorses an 80% economy-wide reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. In 2006, AIA National adopted the 2030 Challenge, which is the basis for this amendment. And AIA Minnesota fully supports the 2030 amendments to the Minnesota Sustainable Guidelines. The U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted the 2030 goals in June of 2006, and similar goals were mandated for federal buildings as part of the 2007 Federal Energy Bill. We foresee achieving these reductions through a combination of building energy efficiency and renewable energy, with energy conservation being the backbone of the reductions. Now, to illustrate the potential for economically reducing emissions related to building energy demand, I have a few examples of buildings constructed in Minnesota over the past few years. Before I show them, I need to clarify that they're benchmarked to a few different standards. And if you talk to architects and engineers in Minnesota, you talk to us about energy efficiency, you'll hear us talk in these terms. One is we benchmark buildings better than Minnesota code. And essentially, this is typically reported in the percent of energy cost savings. We also benchmark it back to a national standard, ASHRAE 90.1, and that's what LEED, or Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design certified buildings, are benchmarked to. And then there's also better than average on-site energy use. This first set of building examples are actually better than Minnesota code examples. And they all have a 2 to 5 year payback. The first project is the University of Minnesota's Medical Bioscience Building. This project is just now breaking ground, and we're just starting to complete the design work, actually. The energy modeling is showing that the building should operate about 43% better than Minnesota code, and in a simple energy savings over 40 years should save about $15 million, and that's in today's energy crisis. This slide is of the University of Minnesota Molecular Cellular Biology. This building was constructed about 4 or 5 years ago. It's 41% better than code, 40-year savings of about 226,000 tons of CO2, and the dollar savings at about $24 million. McGuire Translational Research Facility, it's designed to 43% better than code, 40-year savings of over 117,000 tons of CO2, and a $10.5 million savings in energy. This is the Winona State Science Center, 42% better than Minnesota code, 40-year savings of 72,000 tons of CO2, $6.5 million in energy savings. This slide is the Alina headquarters at the Midtown Exchange, 42% better than code, 65,000 tons of CO2 saved, $5.9 million. This is an image of the Wilder Center, which just started or just opened in January. It's at University in Lexington Parkway. We're predicting that this building should operate about 40 to 45% better than code, has a payback of about 5 years, and it's roughly 35% better than the national average on similar buildings. So this building meets the 2030 challenge target, the current target. This is an image of the Great River Energy headquarters. It's still under construction in Maple Grove. Should open in April. Right now, it's predicted to be about 50 to 60% better than Minnesota code. It's about 50% better than ASHRAE, 90.1, and approximately 40% better than the national average. And that meets the 2010 to 2015 targets for this bill. Our nation has been energy efficient in the past. Between 1973 and 1983, carbon emissions from buildings were flat, while adding over 30 billion square feet of new construction and increasing the GDP by $1 trillion. We have better technology today, and as architects, we have improved design tools through computers, which allow us to better predict the performance of our designs. We can significantly reduce carbon emissions just like we did 30 years ago. We can do that again today. And as a profession, we have started dealing with global warming, and we are preparing to lead our building sector, the building sector of the economy, towards significant carbon reductions, but we can't do it alone. In order to make our buildings energy efficient and carbon neutral, we need the participation of local and state governments. The private sector, lenders, utilities, facilities managers, building users, contractors, and manufacturers. Ultimately, building owners need to request it, and society will need to embrace it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And many of us had the opportunity to tour the Great River Energy headquarters. It was really amazing. I think it's a wonderful location and a great opportunity for community education by having that located where it's at. So thank you. Questions, members? Representative
Taylor. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Pierce, you ended on such a great note for me to segue into one of the disappointments I had about the bill. I think it's a phenomenal bill. And when I spoke with Ed Masria, architect, I actually was able to meet with him personally in New Mexico when I was down there last month in January. And he was really impressed that we're doing this, and I'm impressed that I'm glad that Janet Streth is here, who helped facilitate that technical working group for MCAG and really developed a nice consensus around being able to do the approach that's in the DE amendment and in the bill. But I was shocked to learn that Mr. Masria was able to get into the 2007 energy bill the 2030 standards that are in our bill applied to all federal buildings. And I'm a little disappointed that, while I appreciate consensus, I think that we have a lot of work to do, hopefully even short of the first 3-year report, to convince the people of Minnesota and this body that we should be, we should have very little tolerance for waste and inefficiency in our government buildings. And I think we have a lot of homework to do to make the case, but as the numbers that you've shown, as Mr. White and Mr. Carmody have shown, it makes sense. If we're good stewards of the public dollar, we should be doing this, and we should have everybody on board, especially if we're going to meet our challenges and boost our economy. And as Mr. Carmody knows, I don't see him. Oh, there he is. We are the Silicon Valley of winter. And so by tightening these codes, these jobs and the economic development will happen in Minnesota. From Representative Saylor's district on down to Representative Welty's, where I think State Electrochromics is very close by, all of our districts are going to benefit from doing so. But I want to congratulate all of you for working so hard on the bill and say that we're not done yet. I think we have some work to do.
Madam Chair, Representative Palin, thank you very much for the response, and I agree that there are a lot of things that we can do, and we need to push things forward for a variety of reasons, and we can do it economically, and it can grow our economy here in Minnesota. Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you again for your testimony. Further questions? Seeing none, Representative Hilton renews his motion that House File 3401 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.